Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is the 9th of April, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We welcome all of you to the program and thank you very much. And we are, well, we're really happy to have the group assembled that we have. And also, we are going to go into a whole range of topics and find out what's going on and try to make sense of it all, which may be easier said than done. We're also, yesterday we spent a lot of time on the program talking with listeners about their thoughts on the eclipse, mm-hmm. and now it's happened, so I assume people also have stories, so be interested in those as well. Kudos to our great team of Sarah LaDuke and Ian Pickus and Rob Chacone and all the people who helped out on that live broadcast from 3 to 4. It was really terrific to have local coverage there in Tupper Lake. And if you get a chance, if you missed it, and I know, you know, and you want to relive the radio version of the eclipse, it's really a lot of fun and some really good information.
Yeah, I saw it. I listened to it early in the evening last night. I found it on Facebook.
Yeah, I watched it. I did watch Facebook Live. I thought that was kind of neat because I was looking for something to put on my phone to bring it out with me. And then I realized that was there, and I was like, oh, this is cool. And so we didn't in our way, where Judy and I live, we were at like 98%. It wasn't totality, but it was still pretty cool and a lot of fun. JP, how did you manage?
I wasn't in totality. I was at probably 99% near Saratoga Springs. I had a delightful time, and I thought it was really cool. And I'm kind of surprised it doesn't happen more, that the moon doesn't block out the sun more, you'd think. But, you know, I'm ignorant on this. I guess the next time we're going to get it is 2079. And who knows how many of us will be around in 2079.
There's a happy thought.
Well, that's absolutely correct. So let me ask, was it a family affair? Were the kids involved?
We had some people in the neighborhood. The kids were involved. All right, so the kids that I was with were a little, I'm just being honest, they were a little young to fully appreciate the profound nature and historic event that it was that we all experienced. I had some other friends who I wasn't with, but they were with some older kids who did think it was really cool. There was someone in my neighborhood playing Pink Floyd music, which was kind of, I thought, was apropos and had some better goggles than we had. My wife put together the paper plate version, which worked really well to blot out the excess sun. But I thought it was great. I thought it was something that the entire state and country kind of got excited about. And it's not controversial. We all like to see it, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I think it was very nice and fun and to see people. The thing that struck me, and by the way, I'll admit we're treading water a little bit because we're waiting for Mike's Mediator, but I just figured I'd be honest with you all. The thing that I thought was really cool is as we reached as much as we were going to get, 98%, 99%, whatever it is, the owls went nuts. Like, it was so cool. And we live on top of a mountain and there's a lot of forest around but the birds and the owls were fascinating, and especially the owls because they have that very distinctive whoo, whoo. And suddenly I'm doing Rich Guthrie. but it was really, that was fun. And then to see the shadows and the different things, it was just it was really very special and sort of something that everyone could get into, and that was really fun. It was neat. Mike Spain has entered the building. Hi, Mike.
Hey there. How are you?
We're good. How'd you watch the?
You know, my wife Debbie and I got up real early and drove all the way to the Canadian border and into Vermont. And we're in St. Albans, Vermont, in their city park. And it was great.
That's really cool.
Yeah, they had music playing, you know, like Here Comes the Sun and dark, you know, all kinds of, you know, Blinded by the Light and all that.
Did you, what was the traffic?
On the way up, not a lot. On the way back, quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
He probably just got back.
Maybe
that's why he's late.
That was the issue.
It was close to 11 by the time I got back home.
But worth it.
It was worth it, yeah. You know, I actually saw the one in South Carolina in 2017 because we were vacationing a couple hours away, and a few of us hopped in a car and drove down and stopped at a Jersey Mike's sub shop along Route 17 and looked up and then went back to the beach. But this was really cool.
The scientific center that is Jersey Mike's. That's terrific.
And if you're wondering what to do with all those sunglasses that everyone got, I think there are sites online that are collecting them and to send to other countries for when they have their...
They're good for 3 years, and there is going to be another event apparently within that time
elsewhere
in the world.
Yeah.
So the glasses can then go there and kind of have an extra life. Just make sure, don't send them ones that
are all
didn't work for you.
Yeah.
All right. J.P. Miller is here from the Empire Report. Good morning, J.P. Very nice to have
you.
I'll do the official introductions now.
Great
Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back.
It's nice to be back.
Where do you mind telling us where you
were?
Yeah,
we went to Greece.
And nice.
We had a wonderful time. We ate a lot of wonderful food. I went with old friends and we laughed a lot, and the blues there are just spectacular. We went to Athens and then to some of the islands, and it was off season. It wasn't very hot. It was great.
Yeah, you seem tan. Is that
the sun? I got a lot of sun. I was in shorts and t-shirts the whole time.
That's not an eclipse complexion.
I saw a lot of the sun in the last 2 weeks.
And Mike Spain is here, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Really good. And you are going to travel. You haven't traveled yet.
Right. I'm heading to Europe in 2 weeks. I'll be in the Netherlands and then Belgium and Normandy. I'm spending a lot of time in Normandy. Big history tour, I guess.
Well, that's great. Congratulations, and thanks for being with us. All right, so let's talk about things that are going on. I suppose the big story, besides the eclipse, which is still, people are still recollecting, and we'll welcome your letters on that today as well. But the other big story was that Donald Trump said, He's been giving mixed signals about his stance on abortion and kind of putting a finger in the wind, as it were. And so after months of mixed signals, Donald Trump has made a statement on this. He made a video statement, put it on Truth Social. He said in the video on Monday that abortion rights should be left up to the states, remarks that came after months of mixed signals on an issue that he and his advisors have worried could cost him dearly in the election. Mr. Trump said his view was that the states should decide through legislation and that whatever they decide must be the law of the land, and in this case, the law of the state. See what he did there? But he added that he was strongly in favor of exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others. And that's what they will be, Mr. Trump said in the video, which he posted again on Truth Social. At the end of the day, it's about will of the people. That's where we are right now, and that's what we want, the will of the people. Regardless of the fact that the will of the people prior to the overturning of Roe v. Wade said that most of the people wanted abortion to continue to be legal in the country by a fairly large percentage, I believe, 60-some percent?
66
percent. Yeah, 66%.
Like that.
Yeah. And so, and then in capping a long a long-held Republican project, the president worked very hard to put in Supreme Court justices that would see to it that Roe v. Wade be overturned. Since that time, anti-abortion groups have called for a national ban, which would face steep odds in the House and Senate. Mr. Trump did not refer to a national ban in his remarks, but his comments about leaving the matter to the state suggested that he was trying to avoid being pulled deeper into the issue. But politically, Mr. Trump's announcement that abortion should be left to the states allows Democrats to tag him with some of the strictest abortion laws in the country, including a six-week ban in Florida that he has said himself was a terrible mistake. In a statement, President Joe Biden accused Mr. Trump, who appointed three conservative Supreme Court justices who were pivotal in overturning Roe, of fostering, quote, cruelty and chaos surrounding abortion in the wake of the decision. He added that Mr. Trump's position was effectively an endorsement of states that had passed tougher abortion restrictions, including the six-week ban. Judy Patrick.
At the end of the day, it's such a slippery, politically conniving statement. I mean, he's trying to appeal to everyone. And the media, our problem here is we're treating him like a normal candidate. And at the end of the of his statement, he's talking about the Democrats supporting murdering children after they've been born. And instead, we should be focusing on that. And we should also focus on the fact that he is supporting states that choose to have a six-week ban, which is essentially a ban. He didn't talk at all about whether or not he would veto a measure if it landed on his desk if he's elected president to ban abortions nationwide. He didn't talk about any efforts to control the distribution of birth control medicine via the FDA. What he didn't say was just as important as what he did say. I have no confidence in what his position is. It's just a political position at this point. He's trying to appeal to fringe elements. I think he realizes, I think the far right, those people who desperately oppose abortion, know that he'll be there for them in a clutch. If the Republicans win the Senate, if the Republicans win the House, they will adopt a federal abortion ban. It will go to his desk, and people who oppose abortion know he will sign it.
I will say that the proponents, the people who are against choice, are certainly proponents of an abortion ban. Are certainly also giving the president a lot of flack over this as well, saying it's not quite as advertised initially.
Yeah, Mike Pence released a statement saying that Trump, by his statement, is abandoning the right to lifers and turning his back on the right wing. However,
he called it a slap in the face.
Yes, however, it is because of Donald Trump and the three appointments he made to the U.S. Supreme Court that Roe v. Wade was overturned. And personally, I think he's trying to dodge the impact of that, the political impact of that, now that he sees how badly it's going for Republicans in the midterm election. And a lot of states are beginning to, some states are beginning to have referendums, and they're going very strongly in favor of ensuring rights to abortion. And even the state of Florida is having a referendum. And he has not said how he'll vote on that referendum, which would guarantee a woman's right to abortion. And so you have this situation where he wants his cake and eat it too. He basically delivered to the right wing. They're complaining now, but in the end, they got what they wanted, and he expects them to support him. Who are they going to support? Joe Biden? Come on. So he can now appear to be moderate and say, listen to your heart, listen to your faith, and let the states decide. But even in states where they decide legislatively that abortion is restricted to 6 weeks, and as Judy said, that's virtually banning it, even after they decide that is not allowing people to listen to their heart, listen to their faith. They're disenfranchised completely. And, you know, it's He's just trying to sound reasonable when he is the reason that abortion is becoming illegal in many states.
JP, I want to get to you, but I think we're just going to wait for a break and then come back and get to it. But, I mean, that's one of the things that I find fascinating about the segment is of even the headline in the Times that after months of giving mixed signals, the second part of that statement could have been, he gave another mixed signal.
Yes, yes. Indeed. Yeah. Absolutely. Nothing certain here.
No, there was nothing like, oh, okay, that clears it up.
Oh, no.
But we're sort of used to that, as Judy said. It's the there's no such thing, but the normalcy of the Trump campaign.
Exactly, and perfect example about the fact that it was a mixed signal.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our great group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC. First, this, and news.
New York is a woman, she'll make you cry. But to her, you're just another guy. Look down and see her ruined places.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable, listening to the music of Suzanne Vega this morning. Going to be at the Egg tonight, theegg.org for more information, doing a show called Old Songs, New Songs, and Other Songs. Covers all the bases. So, Suzanne Vega, a wonderful performer and just a lot of fun to see, and we'll be at the Egg tonight. You can find out the entire playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. All right. We're talking about former President Donald Trump saying that abortion restrictions should be left to the states. This is his firm commitment after making a non-firm commitment. J.P. Miller.
Well, one thing I think that both Judy and Mike alluded to is that you can count on Trump to double back and answer this question differently at least a dozen different times between now and the election. And the great thing for the Biden campaign, I thought that the video yesterday was so far the best moment of the Biden campaign in 2024 because he has no way of winning on this issue. The more moderate he tries to appear, the more he alienates his base. He's a guy who hates to alienate his base. And when he says he's going to honor, what Florida wants to do and what New York and California want to do, you can be sure that Biden allied groups are going to try to erode his base in swing states. Now, you might say, okay, where are they going to go? Are they going to vote for Biden? But what I would say is in those swing states, there's such a small percentage of voters who are going to decide that to erode his base by anything, not that they're going to flip to Biden, but maybe that they stay home, will be very effective, my belief, for Biden-affiliated groups who can micro-target on Facebook and Google and Twitter. They can get voter profiles of the small percentage of voters who on the right could be persuaded to stay home. So I think that, I thought it was shocking to see Pence and Lindsey Graham attack Trump. You never see Republicans attack Trump, right?
They do briefly, and then Lindsey Graham has done it a couple of times, and then they apologize and go meet him in Mar-a-Lago, and then everything's fine.
But I think it's a remarkable thing that he put out this video. He knows he's screwed on this issue, and his only hope is that this is not the top issue in November, that this is what we're talking about in April, and that in November we're not talking about this. But if you're Joe Biden and you're the Democrats and you're the New York Times and MSNBC, you are going to be talking about abortion every single day between now and November, and it's going to help Biden. It's Biden's by far his best issue.
Yeah, poor Lindsey Graham. Well, I shouldn't say that, but Lindsey Graham.
Really?
Trump flayed him yesterday. He spent the rest of the afternoon just tweet or truth, whatever they are, message after message talking about how poorly that Lindsey Graham should focus more on border issues and not talk about abortion, and that he was bad for the Republican Party. And I'm very curious to see how Lindsey turns this around today, whether he will come crawling back to the Trump position or whether he will stand firm. What's my bet? He's going to come crawling back.
I think he'll be at Mar-a-Lago by dinner.
you also, though, at I was talking about eroding the base a little bit, but in terms of persuading undecided voters, which there are undecided voters, that's who's going to decide the election. What his statement was is he basically is embracing the Florida 6-week ban. That's basically for persuading those voters. That is what he is going to own, and it's going to be over and over and over on that.
Don't you think he's going to have to answer the question, how are you, a resident of Florida, going to vote on the referendum to protect abortion rights or not?
And he won't answer.
And he won't answer. Oh, that's a tough one. I'll have to see what happens. I'll listen to my heart.
I know what I'm going to do, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do.
I'm not going to tell.
Right. Right. And even if he says something,
doesn't
do you
mean
believe?
It's true.
It doesn't mean it's true.
But I think you're right, JP. The risk here is the one that the Democrats always talk about, is the lack of enthusiasm. The right wing, which he has counted on, and they do owe him. He delivered to them. He bragged about giving them the votes on the Supreme Court they needed to turn over Roe v. Wade. And now he's expecting them, despite what he said yesterday, expecting them to come out and support him. And they just might sit down, sit aside, and not want to do it. And you're right. It's a very, very tough situation that he's in.
A huge part of the Republican coalition and pathway to the presidency is disaffected blue-collar working-class voters and the religious right. And he, as part of that, every time he goes in campaigns, he's meeting with religious leaders in Iowa and Wisconsin, and in those venues, he is a guy who always appeals to the base. You never see him appeal to the middle, ever. You never see him try and walk a tightrope. And this is a tightrope that he's going to try to walk. And Biden is going to be strong in this issue. He's going to say, you know, we need to go back to Roe v. Wade. And he's going to he basically doesn't have scrutiny on it. You know, this is his key issue. If they can keep this going, you know, through the summer and fall, Biden's in good shape, in my view.
Is it, my question to the group is it worth the fight in the sense of you just say, okay, Democrats have this issue, and they'll make it that issue, and we're going to toe the party line here, and we're going to work like hell on immigration.
The Republicans.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they are desperately going to try to make immigration the issue, and you can watch them do it. And then in the meantime, you know, he's promising, you know, his campaign donors, you know, more tax cuts. He's doing the speaking directly to different groups, telling them that they're going to do this, he's going to do that. One interesting thing about yesterday was that it was a video. And it looked like he was reading from a teleprompter, which he probably was, which they probably parsed together for him. And that's where he tries to appeal to a broader audience. But if you listen to the excerpts from his speeches on the campaign trail, he's loony. I mean, he's completely makes no sense. He makes mistakes and makes references to everything. But using a video to do it acknowledges that he's not good off the cuff on this topic, and he's going to stick his foot in his mouth, I think, a lot on this. As he, even the conservative, right wing media that covers him a lot, to whom he grants interviews, they'll be asking him how he's going to, what he would do, would he veto a national abortion ban, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think this is going to haunt him for the rest of the election.
The Biden administration did a good job yesterday of counteracting his speech by pointing out the ludicrousy of the fact that the idea that Democrats support murdering children at the end of a pregnancy. This is just not true. I wish the media had done a better job of saying this is not a normal candidate. This is we cannot. There are going to be people out there who believe that of Democrats, and I know there are people who believe that of Democrats. And with the Biden administration forcefully going out and being aggressive, I think for too long they have just sat back and said, you know, these are crazy things. We're not going to address them. Now they're addressing them in a forceful way, in a way that drives home the idea that these things are not true. And again, I don't believe anything he said. I think that he may be telling people, you know, off the record, on the side, that don't worry, I've got your back. We're going to push for this, you know, the FDA ban of this medicine. We are going to do whatever we can to put down a woman's right to control her own health.
I mean, I know there's a lot of hypocrisy here, but it's to say it's up to the states, and knowing how he worked on shaping a Supreme Court to make it a federal law, I mean, that's all you have to point to if you're the Biden campaign.
And can I just say this idea that, oh, yes, but we support the Ronald Reagan approach that we would allow abortion in the cases of rape and incest. Well, first of all, to do that, you have to prove that it was rape or incest. Are we going to require the person who the rapist to be convicted before we allow the abortion? That's just a dodge. It's just an excuse to make it more palatable, and it's just not workable.
And to that point, also saying that I'm in favor. I would support abortion to protect the life of a woman, and that is another one that. That dodges the real issue. If a woman is facing a real tough pregnancy, or if they know that the baby is not going to live, like there's a genetic problem, and carrying it to term would limit their ability to have another child, none of that is included in the life of the woman. It's exactly that, Judy. It's a dodge.
All right, let's take a break there. When we come back, we'll continue. We have some letters on this issue, and we'll move on to other issues this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
I said to Reeves the other day, Proust really is the man who comforts me in a way no other writer can.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a great group this morning, J.P. Miller, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some letters, and panel, feel free to jump in and discuss these as we go through them. Gay writes, the idea that access to health care depends on where you live and on the whims of politicians who are practicing medicine without a license is wrong.
Good letter.
Yeah. It certainly is one of the issues.
And virtually out. Male politicians.
Yep.
Yeah.
Old white male
politicians.
All right. We go to Lisa. Leave it to the states means to throw women and children to the mercy of crazy politicians, ignorant, narrow-minded bigots, and religious zealots to forfeit the hard-won progress away from the victimhood, which has been the plight of women throughout history, and to destroy limits on governmental abuse of power. Like all dangerous power mongers, Trump doesn't give one single crap about anything other than getting power, and yes, everyone knows it.
And if you look at the states where the steps against or the restrictions on abortion are the most severe, those are the states that typically do the least for children and for it's where school teacher salaries are low. It's where child poverty is high. It's where maternal health care is poor. I mean, if they really cared about children and babies, they would spend more of their money to make their first years successful.
Mark writes, unfortunately, as seen in Ohio, leaving it to the states doesn't mean it will be less restrictive. 27 GOP members there signed a statement they will oppose any attempts to loosen restrictions. Then.
It's just a litmus test for a certain part of the electorate, and they're just, I mean, that's it. It's a check. It's a box that they check and say, I'm anti-abortion. And then they get a certain number of votes, and it helps them win.
So we got this interesting letter, but it's in, like, 24-point font.
Large type?
Well, I don't know if I can.
Do you know that in Greece they use a whole different alphabet? It's like, wow! I have no chance of translating these words.
All right, I think I... Damn it. I thought I figured out how to do it. Oh, there we go. This is from Gloria. Reality is that there are no exceptions to abortion. It's a cruel hoax. Think about it. Exception for rape or incest? How does that work? The victim must prove her case in a court of law. How long does that take? Years? Life of the mother? Who really decides that? Doctors are intimidated by these vague laws. Does it go to the lawyers? How long does that take? Meanwhile, women suffer and die. So there are no exceptions in reality, and that is from Gloria. Thank you very much for that note. All right. Anyone else on this issue? Anything we left out of the conversation that you would like to point out? JP is checking his notes, which...
You know, I just think it needs to be said. There's a lot of people... Because of their upbringing and their faith and they have decided that they don't favor abortion. That's not the, but we live in a pluralistic society where if everybody's morals were imposed on everybody else, it would be chaos. And that's exactly what we're watching right now. You can't impose all of your personal moral religious beliefs on other people in a free and open and secular society. And I think that we're seeing the disaster that that creates.
You could not have done a better job than you just did of putting the tee into the ground and putting the ball on that tee for me to discuss the Vatican on grave threats.
Yes.
So let's go there for a few moments. The Vatican says that surrogacy and gender theory are, quote, grave threats to human dignity. The Vatican released a new document calling poverty, war, and the plight of migrants threats to human dignity. Okay. All right. Sounds good. So far, you got me. But it also calls abortion, surrogacy, and gender theory grave threats facing humanity today. There's the Catholicism I know.
Those are just basically reiterating, you know, long-held Catholic teaching.
What we learned, right, Mike?
It wasn't that long ago that it takes a church a long time to sort of understand science and recognize things.
Often thousands of years.
Often. I mean, when did they apologize to Galileo? Maybe back in the 80s, I think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Finally, for his assertion that the world was round. And, it's not often based on science and contemporary understanding of things. It takes a real long time. At least the current pope, Pope Francis, he's the first pope to specifically condemn anti-homosexual laws, and 67 countries have anti-homosexual laws. And he last year, said it's okay for a Catholic priest to bless a gay couple. That's not the same as the sacrament of marriage, and he didn't say that, but he's being criticized by the right wing within the Catholic Church, which is very vocal and very similar to the right wing in our political system here in the U.S. And he has also said that we should welcome people who are transgender. This doesn't call people transgender. It calls it sex change, and it talks about... It just reiterates Catholic teaching, and the fact that it was released was kind of this is where we are right now, but that's evolving. And as I've said to you before, Joe, The Catholic Church will have women priests. They'll have married priests. They'll have acceptance of a lot of these newer ideas. We'll all be dead.
Yeah,
it'll come. You know, just takes time.
The document titled "Infinite Dignity" says that each person's dignity comes from the love of the Creator, quote, who has imprinted the indelible features of his image on every person. This language is familiar to Christians accustomed to hearing that humans are all made in God's image. The document goes on to say that this dignity is inalienable beyond any circumstance or situation the person might encounter. Simply put, because a person exists, a human has intrinsic dignity. Infinite Dignity, the report, details a long list of what it calls grave threats to that dignity, some of which might be expected given other Catholic teachings. It talks about the drama of poverty and how the unequal distribution of wealth denies humans their God-given dignity. It also describes war, the abuse of migrants, sexual abuse, violence against women, the marginalizing of people with disabilities, assisted suicide, and abortion, all as affronts to human dignity. But then the document turns to other issues that have become more highly politicized in recent years: surrogacy, gender theory, and what it calls sex change. The document's framework holds that if a person is made in God's image, gender theory and gender reassignment surgery call into question why God would create a person with the wrong gender. It says that the understanding of humanity as divided into two sexes, male and female, is biblical and deeply meaningful, especially in terms of procreation. Gender theory argues that a person's gender can be different from the sex that person was assigned at birth.
Catholics. I'm not Catholic. I should concede.
Mike and I are Catholic. JP,
yes,
also Catholic.
So
okay,
I'm a Protestant. So but from where I sit, the Catholics that I have known have just kind of ignored papal edicts that they don't agree with.
This is not a papal edict, by the way. This is just a reiteration of a church policy that's been around for decades.
And completely understandable, yeah, given the history of papal dictates or whatever. But the Catholic Church is very strong in a lot of countries. And in a lot of countries, there are draconian measures persecute people who happen to be gay, who happen to be transgender. And I love the idea that the Pope has come out against crackdowns on that kind of lifestyle, but I worry that this will just aggravate or intensify the reaction in this country and elsewhere against transgender and sex change operations and surrogacy, which was a surprise to me.
Yeah, surrogacy was a surprise.
Well, I mean, I kind of understand where that comes from. I mean, there is the potential of it just becoming a transactional monetary exploitation of poor women so that they carry babies for wealthy people. I mean, you can see where there is a risk of that. But all you have to do is talk to parents who have been able to have families because of it, and how wonderful it is. I mean, there's two sides to it, and they seem to be taking the one side where it could be problematic rather than looking at the other side. I know Catholics who've benefited from that, and it's joyous. And you can't, you just can't answer it with one particular rule. It has to have flexibility. And, and really, growing up as a Catholic, I was kind of taught that Jiminy Cricket, let your conscience be your guide kind of theology, where you study it, you listen to it, you draw your conscience from the teaching, and you do exactly maybe what you were saying, Judy, is Catholics kind of skirt by the things that their conscience doesn't agree with. And that's, that's going to get some letters, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, the same, right, as is my statement, which is you go church shopping. You know, I mean, if you find a more liberal priest and teaching who is maybe marrying gay couples or is talking about climate change and talking about issues and talking about the issues within the Catholic Church, you know, that is happening. But then you get these papers from the Vatican.
It's so political, though. It's doing exactly what Trump did. It's like saying something to a constituency that you want to keep active.
JP.
I think that the NPR article to focus on that isn't giving a very fulsome view of what the of what the church's teachings are. They kind of give passing notice of dedication to the poor and immigrants and all that important stuff, and focus on the more
sensational
sensational stuff. You know, also missing from the article, they didn't mention why don't we compare it to other religions? What do the Muslims, you know, how do they treat transgender and gay people? That would be something that I would encourage that author to include in the article. And it also paints a little bit of a picture that the Catholic Church is defined by the leadership of the Catholic Church, which it's not. The Catholic Church is defined by all of the lay people that go to church every week and are parishioners. And when I've been to church, I've seen transgender people at church many times. I've seen gay people at church many times, and not just at church, but actively involved in church. They teach in school, they do readings.
Right.
They're on the altar.
Yeah.
Yes, they are some of the most active and beneficial people to participate in the church, and I think that this author, I think the article, sure it might be factual, but it doesn't quite paint the full picture of where most Catholics are. Most Catholics are made up of a very diverse group of people who have all different views on all different issues, and they certainly do not take their marching orders from the leadership of the church.
With that, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee, and he fills it only halfway, and before I even argue, he is looking out the window at somebody coming in.
And that song will be in your head for the rest of the day. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Welcome. If you are just joining us, we would love for you to be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Did you have more to say, JP? No, I don't. I know we had to go to a break. We've been talking about the Catholic Church and their saying sex change, gender theory are grave threats. And that in a paper that they have, a document they have released called Infinite Dignity. We have a couple of letters on this. One says, my son passed along a very interesting comment regarding surrogates, which was simply, wasn't Mary the original surrogate?
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, that's a good point.
By the way, if you're going to look for hypocrisy, there's a lot of it. Okay. Brian's,
there's different versions of everything.
Yes, yes. You got it wrong, says Brian. The Pope gave permission to bless the individuals in same-sex union, not the relationship. That's a big difference.
Yeah, it was very, very, very parsed, and it went back and forth, and in some places, like in Germany, some priests took that as a full thing, and they had church weddings for gay couples. So they kind of walked it back a little bit and said, we're blessing individuals who are welcome in the church. But I don't think they said bless gay unions. I'd have to go back and read it, but they can bless a gay couple. And to bless someone is, you know, it's really a, you know, it's not the same as sanctifying their wedding or anything like that.
All right. Christopher says, perhaps you could have people on the show who don't believe in mythical beings and aren't members of a cult of sexual predators.
That's a good one.
Yeah. That's.
Wouldn't have a show.
Yeah. I mean, it's not exclusively Catholic to have sexual predators. There's lots of organizations and faiths that have had that. You should point that out.
We should point that out, although, or, I mean...
Even atheists might, you know, be involved in that.
But it's a huge...
Heinous practice.
Huge issue within the church and has rocked it to its core.
Oh, I think that reckoning that it has brought the church is going to be felt for centuries. And it's the church has to climb out of it. You're right.
I mean, and it lost a lot of us who just have a real... problem and have a hard time walking
it's
through
heartbreaking.
The doors. It is.
Yeah.
It is. And especially if you're, and I'm a part of it, obviously a victim, but also someone within a parish where this has taken place. I mean, that's just devastating.
It's devastating. Yeah.
And infuriating the way people were moved around. And, you know, Mike and I have talked about this. When I talk about
just
the movie,
watch the movie Spotlight.
When I have
it
the movie
so
Spotlight,
accurate.
I have Mike come in and talk about it to the students. He's very good at it.
It's excellent.
All right, let's see. Let's go on to other subjects, and we go to this, which is we talked about this a little bit yesterday. This broke as we were doing the show yesterday. We spent most of the show talking about the eclipse, and then this was breaking news, and we mentioned it, but we didn't have a whole lot of time with it. And that is President Biden's announcement regarding student debt relief. President Biden announced a large-scale effort to help pay off federal student loans for tens of millions of American borrowers, seeking an election year boost by returning to a 2020 campaign promise that was blocked by the Supreme Court last year. Mr. Biden's new plan would reduce the amount that 25 million borrowers still owe on their undergraduate and graduate loans. It would wipe away the entire amount for more than 4 million Americans. Altogether, White House officials said 10 million borrowers would see debt relief of $5,000 or more. While a college degree still is a ticket to the middle class, that ticket is becoming much too expensive, President Biden said during a speech to a small but enthusiastic audience filled with supporters. Today, too many Americans, especially young people, are saddled with too much debt. Mr. Biden announced the plan in Madison, Wisconsin, the capital of a critical swing state and the college town that symbolizes the president's promise to make higher education affordability a cornerstone of his economic agenda. I just want to quickly, before we get to the issue at hand, journalists in the room, the phrase, a speech to a small but enthusiastic audience. So my immediate question is it small because nobody showed up, or is it small because it was in a place that would only hold so many people?
And what's the definition of small?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. I thought that was
That's kind of a cliche, hackneyed way of describing it. And it might have been only in people invited. It might have been...
Well, if you're in a school, auditorium and there's 300 seats, well, yeah, that's going to be a small group, but it's not.
I would say that would be a big crowd for Biden.
I'd say give me a number.
That'd be good. If you could fill up 300 seats, that'd be pretty strong.
It just makes it sound like, I don't know. They talk about these Trump rallies and people, you know, thousands of people are showing up, give or take. Couple thousand, and then you go to this, and I just thought it was an odd phrasing. Anyway, well, let's go back to the issue. Mr. Biden announced this in Madison, Wisconsin. It is the president's promise to make higher education affordability a cornerstone of his economic agenda, but it is a promise he has so far failed to achieve, largely because of legal challenges from Republicans and other critics. They accuse Mr. Biden of unlawfully using his executive authority to enact a costly transfer of wealth from taxpayers who have not taken out federal student loans to those who have. Officials did not say how much of the new plan would cost in coming years, but critics have said it could increase inflation and add to the federal debt by billions of dollars. Mr. Biden said his new effort would help the economy by removing the drag of enormous debt from people who would otherwise not be able to buy a home or pursue a more economically sound future? Judy.
Oh, so many ways to take this, but I'm generally in favor of the federal government helping relieve some of the student debt, because I think the federal government played an essential role in creating the debt. But I do not think this does anything to help people in the future better afford college costs. I think that's the issue going forward. How do we rein in the cost of a college education? And this is dealing with past problems. This isn't dealing with us going forward. When the cost of tuition, you know, was hitting the $100,000 mark, even in New York State, UAlbany, it's $26,000 a year for tuition. Back in the day, I think we had a better sense that higher education is a public good that government should do a better job of underwriting. What happened was so many colleges went on spending sprees, building, you know, magnificent castles on their campuses, and the cost of college is simply too high, and that's not being addressed going forward. I think people who have acquired more interest debt than principal, that needs to be addressed. I think people tried to pay off their loans and had a difficult time because the administration of the program was not good. But again, I would like to know that college is too expensive. We as a society need to address that.
Absolutely. Yes, the two sides of this, well, many sides, but that's one part of the problem. JP.
Judy, bravo. I agree. One thing you didn't mention is the college presidents who all make multiple millions of dollars and they're, you know, serving higher education, and their top executives make millions of dollars. And they, like you said, on the spending sprees in the buildings, they hand out these massive contracts to the developers. The only richer person in Syracuse than the Syracuse University president is
the basketball coach.
Well, the basketball coach, right? That comes out of tuition. And then also, you know, the construction and real estate family who builds all those buildings. And people, you know, going to Syracuse University are expected to pay $80,000 or $100,000 a year. And parents and families are in a really tough situation when a kid gets to college age, and you don't want to say to a kid, you know, well, let's look at the cost benefit analysis of where you want to go. You want to say to your kid, wherever you want to go, we are going to make it happen. And the student at 17 and 18 years old is told, you know, yeah, you know, we'll borrow money, and you
just
borrow money
here.
And this is something that, as they get into my age bracket in their late 30s and 40s, then they realize, oh man, you know, this is getting tough. And the other thing about it is, the federal government spends so much money on so much stupid stuff. They could easily do this and change people's lives by forgiving this debt. So I don't think it's necessarily, I agree, Judy, it's not necessarily a bad policy to forgive this student debt. It would free a lot of people from financial heartache, but I would love to see it paired with what's the plan going forward in terms of reining in the cost of colleges and universities.
Because it almost becomes, and lately I've have a niece and we're looking, with her parents, obviously, but sort of looking at colleges and so forth and having those discussions. And it's fascinating to me because the colleges are, you know, they want you to be a student, and the way they go about it is like, it's monopoly money. You know, it's just, well, you don't have to worry about that for, and then you're gonna have such a great job, you're gonna pay it off. Mm-hmm. The sales job is pretty convincing to put so many of these kids and their parents and their guardians into deep debt.
And it's a real problem for my industry, the newspaper industry, because you get students come out of college with, you know, $100,000, $150,000 worth of debt. Can they afford to take a job in the newspaper industry? They cannot.
They
have to get PR jobs. I mean, it was an issue 25, 30 years ago when I started, but it wasn't this issue. I mean, there is no way a lot of these kids coming out of Syracuse, for example, with great educations in journalism can really start at a small local newspaper.
No. No, yeah. Even if they exist. Mike?
Yeah, I'm just going to agree with JP and Judy. You know, we do bail out, have bailed out the big banks. Airlines we've bailed out. The automakers we've bailed out. You know, we have this argument that it's for the good of the country to bail out these big groups because everyone will benefit from stabilizing these. Well, I think it's true. If we stabilize the people, the students who carry this heavy debt, they're going to lift their own lives and they're going to lift others too, and it's going to help everybody, but indirectly, not directly, but a lot of people directly also. But it ignores the greater problem is how to rein it in. Was it Vanderbilt was $98,000 and change as their new retail price for a year room and board and tuition, and other colleges are approaching that. So, it should be the caveat should be that most people don't pay retail.
Well, and what I would say though is, and you look at that's the cost today,
right?
I've got a daughter who's 1 year old, and you look at the growth, so it's $100,000 a year now. By the time she goes to school, it'll be $200,000 a year.
Well, you think only that?
Oh, you dreamer.
That's optimistic.
All right, so.
Well, right, and then what do you do? And then that's the real question. You know, my students often will look up when you're talking and saying, is this worth it? Like,
You better put on a show.
The money I'm paying to have you here, is that worth it?
They just question, like, okay, we're doing this, but is this, now, in fairness, back to Judy's point, I'm talking to communication majors mostly. And these are people who are going to go out and either try television, radio, print, or public relations, and or mass media, film, whatever, and so, but it is it's a completely legitimate question. What is it? What am I going to get out of this? I think as they get older and as they think about it, it's sort of a like, all right, I'm sorry, why are we doing this again? What's this? How's this going
to
work?
What's this supposed to do?
Our society has convinced people that the only way to success, financial success in life, is through a college education. And that's not always the case, too. Not everybody needs a college education.
I heard on Ray Graff's afternoon program last week where a guy was talking about what an apprentice electrician makes an hour, and a lot of college grads would be happy to make that much money.
Now, the Republican talking point will be, well, you took out the loan. You're obligated to pay back the loan. I took a loan out of my boat or my house, and I feel like I need to pay this back. And that has a certain logic to it. But when you really look at what happened with the college loan, it's a debacle. I mean, kids are trying to pay a lot of these loans back, but they get the runaround. And the interest rates were high at a time when the interest rates for cars were 0 or 1%. These guys were paying 5, 6%.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not their fault. I think it's totally justified for the federal government to step in. I don't know if we'll survive a court challenge. It seems targeted in a way that it may have some ability to survive.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we're into this situation now where you can't get Congress to agree on anything, like a bailout of anybody, and especially students, privileged students who got through college. But the I say that with quotes around it because I don't mean that in any derogatory way, but it is used that way sometimes. But we do have a situation where now it's the lawyers for the White House will go through every obscure law looking for some rationalization under some federal law that gives authority to the president to do something, and then he'll use that to do this, and then it will go to court, and then it will go back and forth, and there might be some part of it might be thrown out. I mean, this is the way everything is now, not just student loans. And it's just because Congress is just so completely unable to do anything.
All right. We have just a few moments before the bottom of the hour break, and we'll move on to other topics on the other side as we finish up this morning. Al writes, I just say that Boston University journalism in 1974 and 75 and went out and got my clips as a student and small newspapers. So it's possible to get your clips and get out and get a job after graduation. The bigger issue is whether the Connect newspaper change will, or the current, I think that's what that means, the current newspaper change will shut down the newspaper. This is the evil empire for another discussion because it's destroying local news coverage.
A topic Judy can speak particularly about.
In the 1970s, it was different. I mean, small newspapers have never been, people don't go into journalism to make a lot of money. They go into it for a greater good, I think. And you can live your whole life and end it happily, knowing that you contributed to society. But you're not making a ton of money. I mean, some reporters do, but most reporters don't. It's just the nature of our profession.
Robert writes, fortunately, I did not have student debt, but I am old, and I recently found one of my college bills for tuition, room, and board, $1,800 a semester.
Yeah.
Also,
early 70s, late 60s, he must right. be talking about. Yeah.
I'm really very happy you mentioned that, Mike. Also, where was this much pushback with the mortgage relief in the 2000s? Hmm. Again, fair point.
Bailing out the savings and loans, remember that?
Claire says, I'm sorry, but everyone should look at the cost-benefit analysis of a particular college. Saying to a kid you can go anywhere you want to go and signing up for loans to make that happen is just ridiculous. Go to the best college that you can afford. Teach your kids financial responsibility and to leave within their means. Free community college is an excellent start. Then we go to Thomas, who simply says on this matter, if you lose the interest, that's gathered would help a lot too. Michelle says, I don't understand why more of the rhetoric about student loan forgiveness is not about the interest. It would make for a much stronger argument against those complaining about paying for others' education.
And the other thing I like to mention is that we tend to idolize the higher priced universities and colleges.
Absolutely.
Economically, it makes great sense to go to a two-year college and then maybe transfer to a more expensive college. But then you get people to say, "Oh, that's not your education. The 2 years not so good." People are breathless at the idea that they've got accepted into Harvard or Yale or Princeton, and they'll pay whatever. They'll sign up for. They'll make the deal with the devil in terms of student loans, because they want this prestigious degree.
And I feel we would not be doing our due diligence if we didn't mention the fact that, the opposite of that, not polar opposite, but the opposite of that would be going to a smaller college, like the College of St. Rose, mm-hmm. and colleges all across this country of that size that are going out of business and are having a really, really tough time for a lot of the reasons that we've yep. mentioned.
What I would say, though, Judy, not that I don't know because I certainly didn't go to an Ivy League college, but I would look at the Harvard and the Yales. Those might be expensive. Those, I would imagine, overall are positive return on investment. I look at some, and I don't want to pick on Syracuse, but Syracuse is not Harvard, but it's just as expensive as Harvard. What's the return on investment on Syracuse and those small colleges? Some are high priced, some are low priced.
Right.
What is the ROI? And that is certainly the right conversation to have. It's just when you have a young person, I imagine.
You can't get definitive answers about what it's going to be like 20 years from now if your degree was in X or Y. I mean, it's a gamble all the way.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right.
Right. Like right now, they need primary care doctors. So a lot of people are going in to be primary care doctors.
We're running short on teachers, have you noticed?
Yes,
and
nurses.
And the College of St. Rose is closing, and that was what they did. And it's just the irony there is palpable.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our discussion with our terrific panel, J.P. Miller, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain. We always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you in the remaining moments of the program. In the meantime, we will go to news from the BBC.
You don't ask why. Just don't argue anymore.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. If I said that twice, it was because I had my volume of my earphones down and I didn't hear myself speak. Is that that is a sin? Good morning and welcome back to the program. We welcome you to be a part of our discussion as we wrap up this morning. And thank you very much for being with us. Let's see. A couple more letters on tuition. The panelist is incorrect. My understanding is that the total cost, not just tuition, might be $26,000 a year at UAlbany. That includes food, housing, books, and other student fees. I think that needs to be clarified. Okay. I think that does go back to a point that one of our panelists made. I thought it was JP, but it may be Mike. Not everybody pays the same thing. I mean,
It's based on so many different factors.
Yeah.
It could be merit. It could be your income, your family income, and your ability to pay. And it could be
in-state, out-of-state,
all that
stuff. Yeah. I'm sorry, but everyone should look at the okay, I did read that one. And I think we may be done.
Government support. Statewide, on the state level and federal level of colleges, is not what it used to be proportionately, and that's a good point to make. And I think Judy started to make that too.
Tricia writes, while there are some apprenticeships leading to jobs that pay really well, negating the financially benefiting need for a college education, think about the liberal arts education's influence on a voting public. More education means more thoughtful voting, bringing a more just and prosperous society. That's a cool letter. Okay. Let's move on to our last topic for today, and I think it'll be our last topic. See, we have about 10 minutes or so and figure out what else is going on. So it seems that I have a version of this story ever since Speaker Johnson was given the gavel for Speaker of the House that goes something like this. Speaker Johnson's job is once again on the line. And it is it's a regular headline, and it appears in the Washington Post once again today. As the House returns, there are deep divisions on issues like Ukraine and border security. And the article looking at how that may force the Speaker to once again turn to Democrats to pass his priorities. House Republicans are dreading their return to Washington on Tuesday, anticipating their deep divisions will jeopardize high-stakes legislation in a way that may end in the ouster of Speaker Mike Johnson and further throw the chamber into even more dysfunction. Whether Johnson remains Speaker hinges on if the Republicans decide to satisfy demands from his furthest right flank or turns to Democrats, who could ultimately save his speakership in a bid to pass his priorities. He's gotten himself down to a catch-22, Representative Kevin Hern of Oklahoma said, a Republican, who chairs the largest ideological faction of conservatives, the Republican Study Committee. The next 2 weeks are the most critical of Johnson's nearly six-month tenure, which is getting to be a record. His tenure atop a very wobbly House of Representatives with a majority that continues to narrow. His chief priority is passing a bill funding Ukraine that also sends aid to Israel and Indo-Pacific allies. Unlike a national security package that passed the Senate, House Republicans across the ideological spectrum insist that any foreign aid must also include measures that strengthen U.S. borders. But the shape of that package will be fiercely debated, and a route to passage is unpredictable and quite murky. With just a two-vote majority, Republicans have been unable to achieve consensus on such divisive issues, angering a far-right desperate for ideological purity. Choosing a bipartisan route is also complicated. Getting lawmakers to agree on anything related to Ukraine and Israel, especially with outrage mounting about civilian casualties in Gaza, is an almost impossible task given the partisanship and anger in today's House of Representatives. That from the Washington Post. JP.
I've been in here and had this discussion before a couple of times, and it's hard to know what is real and whether he is really in danger of losing his speakership What I have noticed over the last couple of months is a number of Republican retirements in Congress. Their numbers have gone down a few just over the last couple of months. And what I find interesting about this is that we here live in New York and we have the Senate Majority Leader is Chuck Schumer. And should the Democrats take over the Congress, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the top Democratic leader, will be the Speaker of the House. So you have, you will have, should the Democrats take over the Congress, two of the most powerful people in Washington be from New York State, not just from New York State, from New York City, and not just from New York City. Both Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries are both from the borough of Brooklyn. That's not certain.
And they were both big figures in Albany during the assembly, you know, when they were in the assembly.
Yeah. So I don't have, though, a view of whether Mike Johnson will survive the year as Speaker or not. I have to imagine that the Republicans know that they're up for re-election, and the more they look dysfunctional, the less likely they are to win re-election. So they will, I imagine, not put him out, but you can't put anything past that crowd of Republican Congress members.
Judy?
You know, this started to happen 2 weeks ago, and there was some thought that when they were on recess, things would cool down and clearer minds would prevail. You know, this would be entertaining if it wasn't so serious. And it's bad for Republicans. It's going to be bad for them at the polls this November. But it's bad for Democrats. It's bad for the system. It's bad for the institution of government because it makes the average American say none of them are any good. And I think that will affect voter turnout in November, which will affect both Democrats and Republicans. Can the Republicans get someone more conservative than Mike Johnson? I don't think so. I think that's what they're looking at this point. But I do think aid to Ukraine is essential. I think they are running out of bullets, and this is an existential crisis for Europe in general. Mike Johnson, whether he takes the high road and pushes this spending bill through and in exchange for giving up the speakership, you know, he had it for 6 months. I hope he enjoyed the office and all its luxury. Is it time for the Congress to take another break? It seems like, you know, it must be time.
Yeah.
Well, summer's coming, right?
That's right. More recesses. Yeah. I think the Democrats are going to keep him in power if Marjorie Taylor Greene does force another vote, which she's threatened to do and sort of says she might, and she's already started that, but she's holding back. And I think the reason is they know that that's the only way to keep things stable till the end of the year. But I do think Mike Johnson's days are numbered. I don't know what's going to happen in the next election if the Democrats are going to, you know, take over the House. There's some scenarios where they don't. There's some scenarios where the Senate, even if the House does go Democratic, the Senate may very well go Republican, and you won't have that New York kind of a leadership in both houses. And it's all up in the air. But I think that there's enough. I think Hakeem Jeffries is very sharp. He's being coached by Nancy Pelosi, who was very sharp. And he will probably let some of his members make up the difference if there's defections among the Republicans should Speaker Johnson go up for another vote. And in return, I think they'll get a vote on Ukraine. I'm really hoping that they do.
Tom Suozzi from Long Island has already said that he would vote.
He did, yeah.
I mean, the other story that I had on the docket yesterday, we didn't get to it, but is that the Republicans in the House are just running for the door.
JP mentioned, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, they're leaving, and where, you know, what's
some are leaving now,
right? Like
they're not even waiting until their term is.
I'll be my desk will be cleaned out by the end of the day. Thank you very much. And I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, I do think, like, you know, I understand. I think if you go in there with good principles and you see what's happening, you get so disillusioned, you're like, all right, I'm out of here. But I I also, that doesn't, you know, forgive them for the for previous sins, but I do wonder, you know, this margin is so slim of what that will mean for the party. And certainly another go around where we have weeks and weeks of trying to find a new speaker, if that is to happen, will just, I think, push many more people to the door.
Yeah. And what's it going to do for, how this is going to play out in November, when will people take it out on their Republican incumbents? And in close races, I think it's going to make a difference. I don't think it is in, you know, the totally red districts, but I think in some close races, it could be the change. Yeah.
I think Marjorie Taylor Greene just wants attention. I think
you're right about that.
And she's addicted to it. And whether or not she cares about Mike Johnson, I think, is beside the point. And she'll keep this going. She'll dangle this as a possibility for, I think, another week or 10
power.
Days.
She gave Biden a huge gift by making that scene at the State of the Union. And Biden gave the most human response of shock and awe when he saw her. And that is that's something that we've all seen, you know, hundreds of times. And I thought it was a huge positive for Biden.
Yeah, because you just sort of looked up and go, oh, the circus is in town. All right, great. Let's go.
Yes.
We mentioned this yesterday, but I do, you know, again, she was also the one who said that the earthquake last week and the solar eclipse yesterday are God's way of telling us to repent.
Well, that just is another example. I think somebody said it yesterday on the show, too. Another example of how the education of people in the South sometimes is lacking, because they don't devote enough money to educating their students if they're generating people like Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, and Judy Patrick, thank you all. I appreciate it. We'll be back right after this.